You're listening to Around Comics, episode 170. Comics, the comic culture podcast. I'm Christopher Niesman, and I'll be your guide for the next hour plus of comic book news, information, and entertainment. Coming up on this episode, we talk with Eric Powell. He is the creator of The Goon. Then the quiet panelologists at work continue their A to Z, or Z, of British comics. Jeremy Mullins is here for another webcomic recommendation. Tom Caters returns as the Answer Man. Writer Will Pfeiffer gets us ready for the week ahead with new DVD releases and his cult DVD pick of the week. Jerry Duggan returns to the show for an in-depth discussion about the Writers Guild of America strike and his new project, Infinite Horizon, that he's doing with Phil Noto. The Collected Comics Library's Chris Marshall is here for this week's trade paperback and collected edition releases. And then Tom Caters gets us ready with his highlighted list of new single issue releases for the week. All that and more is next on Around Comics. Writer-artist Eric Powell is certainly no stranger to mainstream comics, but it's with his creator-owned series at Dark Horse, The Goon, that he's really made his mark. We were lucky enough to catch up with Eric right after the release of Chinatown, his first Goon original graphic novel. It was a serious, quite literally a serious departure for The Goon, and that's where we pick up the conversation here, talking about The Goon, Chinatown. Congratulations on the Goon graphic novel Chinatown. I just finished reading that about 2-3 weeks ago and really enjoyed it. Congratulations for the accomplishment of putting out a graphic novel.
Oh, thanks. I'm really excited the reaction it got. I was kind of expecting maybe, you know, some people would like it, and then there would be, you know, the other half that would tell me to, you know, kind of shut up and go back to, you know, doing something funny.
Sure. I mean,
you seemed to get a pretty universal good response, which was nice. It was really cool that everybody, you know, kind of let me do something that's kind of off track like that.
Well, you took, I think, two big leaps that I felt that number one, you took a series that had done very, very well in single issues, and you jumped right into a graphic novel to tell a much bigger story. And like you said, you're kind of known for The Goon being a very funny book, and you kind of announced big bold letters right off the bat that this ain't funny.
Yeah, part of the reason I wanted to do the story as a graphic novel was because it was such a, you know, departure from the series that I thought, you know, that we had some discussion about publishing it as like a mini series or a series of issues or something like that, and I was really against it because, you know, The Goon is known for being this funny comic, and I thought if, you know, The Goon is in the middle of this, you know, emotional scene in the story, and someone just kind of picks up the comic and, you know, kind of thumbs through it or whatever, it's just going to kind of come off as kind of funny.
Sure.
You know, like, oh, is this supposed to be funny? You know, is this, you know, him crying over some girl or something? Is that a joke? I don't get it. You know, that kind of thing. So I thought the story should be told in a giant chunk in a graphic novel.
Sure, that was actually, if we're talking about the same sequence that we talked about it on the show a couple weeks ago, our regular roundtable show, and I think it was five pages that you kind of showed the mental collapse of the goon. And
yeah,
you know, these full headshots, and I'm reading that, the entire time I'm thinking this is something that you almost can't do in a conventional comic, and that's when it just kind of clicked for me. It's like, yeah, this story had to be as a graphic novel. It wouldn't have worked any other way.
Yeah, because five pages out of a 22-page comic, that's a big chunk, you know. And originally, the story I had it slated is like, you know, we were going to do it as a little hardcover or something, but I think my original projection was maybe 48 pages or 60-something pages. As I started laying out the story, you know, I was like, there's no way I can do this, and it ended up, you know, doubling and ended up around 110 pages or something like that.
Yeah, but I never felt like anything was rushed, and at the same time, I don't feel like you padded it. It felt, you know, that's one of the nice things about a graphic novel is that you have as much or as little room to tell your story as you want.
It's really the only goon story I've done so far that I haven't had to tweak or cram or something to make it work in the format of the single issue comic book. So that was nice. It was a good experience being able to, you know, just do the story, make it as long as it needs to be, and do whatever I need to do to tell the story. So
sure,
that was really cool.
Another thing I liked about it is that, you know, you guys, it looks like you were serious from the get-go in the presentation. It is a beautiful hardcover presentation. That had to make you really happy when you saw the final product.
Yeah, I have an awesome book designer named Amy Ardens.
Mm-hmm.
At Dark Horse, and she did the Fancy Pants book and all the trade paperbacks and everything. I just kind of gave her like a direction, and I said, I want, you know, this, and I want this color scheme, and she ran with it and did an amazing job.
That's fantastic. Now, I'm sure that a lot of folks that may have not been fans of the Goon previously may have picked this up. What do you think their reaction is going to be if this inspired them enough to go out and get the regular series? What do you think the reaction will be?
I don't know.
We're going to find out, I guess, huh?
There could be some major disappointment there.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I don't know. Hopefully that the point has gotten across that this is a bit of a departure and not the same thing as the ongoing series. So maybe that'll give them a little bit of warning.
Yeah. Now, what's the reaction been from your existing fan base? Because Goon fans, I'm sure, are pretty ardent about being Goon fans, and it seems like you have a pretty close creator fan relationship with that fan base out there. What's the reaction been like?
I've been completely positive. I think I got one, there was like one guy on the message board who, said he was kind of disappointed. He was expecting it to be more like, The Godfather or something like that. And I was like, well, I mean, he didn't say exactly what was wrong with it. He just kind of said, it was kind of a letdown. I was expecting something epic like The Godfather. And I was like, well, he's comparing it to probably the greatest gangster film ever made, so maybe his expectations were a little high. Other than that, it's been like a universal positive response.
Well, if you have one person on the internet complaining about it, I would say that's kind of a runaway success.
I'm sure, I mean, as somebody listens to this and they hated it, they'll probably, you know, chime in, which is fine, but
sure. Well, speaking of the new series, the Goon, that's another thing, is that you did take some time off from the regular series to do this, and now the Goon is back. Issue 20 just came out a couple weeks ago as this episode is being released, and it was kind of right back into, I don't want to say the same old Goon, but it was definitely a very, very humorous, but the supernatural bent to it that Goon fans have come to appreciate and expect. One change, though, is that you have Dave Stewart working on colors now. So how's it been working with Dave on that?
It's been really great. He brings an element to the comic that I just wasn't able to bring. It's like when you're working on this stuff, you're always under a deadline, and naturally, the last thing that you're going to work on is the, you know, the color. And so that was always the area that felt a little rushed to me, and I wasn't, you know, putting all the little bells and whistles in there that I could have because of, you know, just the time constraint. Having him come on board, one, he's amazing, and two, he's, you know, he's able to go in there and actually, you know, really polish everything up. Issue 20 actually didn't print that well. It came out a little dark. I wish everyone could see, like, the screenshots that I got from Dave, because they're like, so much better than what actually printed. Wow. So hopefully the next couple of issues, you know, we can adjust the printing a little bit and get it to print a little bit lighter and, you know, so you can, the full effect being.
Well, one of the things in the back of the issue, and I just talked about your fan base a little earlier and how dedicated they are. You had some great pictures of some fans with goon tattoos. How weird is that for you to either get pictures in the mail or have people at conventions walk up to you and say, "Hey, I just had your creation permanently tattooed onto my body."
It's a little weird. It's a little weird. it's like, wow. I think about the things, you know, I don't have any tattoos because every time I come up with an idea, I, you know, give myself a mandatory, I should think about this, you know, time. And I always get sick of the idea before I actually get anything done, you know, because it's going to be permanently on your body. I guess you really should be in love with the idea before you, you know, get something tattooed.
I think that's some pretty sage advice.
Yeah.
Think about it. Just take a day or two.
But I think about the things that I would get tattooed and how much they mean to me. And for somebody to, like, think, to have that much of a connection with the character and the comic and everything, to actually get a tattoo of it, that means a lot. It's really extremely flattering.
But at the same time, do you have any, like, Kathy Bates misery moments with that?
Not so far. I haven't had any, like, overtly weird tattoo things, like I have your name on my ass or something like that, you know.
Nice.
It's pretty cool. I can't complain too much about that.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Again, it's really flattering.
Yeah. I can just imagine, you know, someone walking up to you at a con and, you know, pulling up a pant leg and saying, "Oh," and that's has to be, you know, it's like, is that real? Do you have to check it?
Yeah.
Make sure that it's not just drawn on?
Yeah, I actually did that. This last, actually, one of the photos you're talking about in the comic, I did a little Frankie, like, 5-second doodle for a guy, and he got it tattooed on his leg. And he showed it to me, and I'm like, is that real? You know, it had my signature on there and everything. And I know what my little 5-second doodles look like, so I know that's what it was. And he's like, "Yeah, you did this little drawing for me, and I got it tattooed on my leg."
Wow.
And I was like, wow. If I'd have known you were going to get it tattooed, maybe I would have, you know, doodle or something. But,
That's cool. Well, speaking of Frankie, I think he's a lot of people's favorite character in the series. I mean, Goon is obviously the title character, but Frankie is really a great character. Where'd the inspiration for that character come from?
I honestly don't know. I always liked the idea of the big guy having the little, you know, buddy around and everything, and kind of like, you know, the straight man, and the Goon is obviously the straight man in the series. He's there just to, you know, bat dialogue back to Frankie, and Frankie is the one who's the, you know, the nut. I don't know. I could pull like 100 sources out on that one. That would be like, you know, the old Warner Brothers cartoons where there's the big dog and the little yappy dog.
Sure. Hey Spike, how you doing? Where are we going?
Yeah. Sure. The Andy Griffith Show. I'm a big fan of the Andy Griffith Show. I don't know why. I just love it. And it's like, you know, Andy kind of the straight man and Barney is the, you know, kind of comic relief.
How'd you, where'd the line knife to the eye come from? Because that's one of my favorites in the series. Whenever Frankie gives a good knife to the eye, that's always a highlight in the issue for me.
That's one of those things that just kind of popped up once in the comic and I liked it, so I kept doing it. Mm-hmm. It just seems like something really vicious to do to stick something in somebody's eye, you know, because it's not like, hey, you stab me in the arm, you know, you can go get it bandaged up. You know, you stab somebody in the eye, that's kind of permanent, you know, they're going to be blind. So,
it's going to leave a mark.
Vicious actually stabbing somebody in the eye, you know, and I think the first time I did it, it was like some little squid guy or something, and he was like, you know, knife to the eye, and I just thought it was funny, so I thought I should make it like a reoccurring thing.
Oh, absolutely. It's a great line. And like I said, whatever happens, it's always a great moment in the comic, and usually, you know, the climax of a, you know, a big battle, and, you know, Frankie has to, you know, goes right for the eye, and it's like, okay, you know, they're going to win now. We got a good knife to the eye line there. Well, you are a native Tennessean, correct?
Right. Yep.
We have one of those that's relocated to Chicago by the name of Mike Norton, and I sent Mike an email today and asked him if he had any questions for you or any funny stories, but he said he didn't have any questions or funny stories, but he sent this cryptic email back and wanted me to ask you about the kid at the Nashville Fairgrounds that got mauled by a dog.
Oh my God. I think Mike, I can't remember if Mike was there. I think he was with us. I was with Mark Ballard, who runs some little local comic conventions here. And we were going to the Nashville Fairgrounds. He was showing me where they were setting up the next day or something. And he stops to talk to this woman. And I'm assuming that he knows this lady because of the way he's talking to her.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just like, hey, how's it going? And blah, blah. And I'm trying to remember the way this went. She was holding a kid. That's right. She was holding a kid. And the kid had, like, a stitches or something in his head. And they're sitting there talking. And all of a sudden, she just started going, and this one here got mauled by a dog. and I was just like, what? What did she just say? And then we kind of drove away. And I was like, who was that? Is that somebody you know? And he's like, no, I don't know her. But he was just talking. And she's just blabbing on about this kid getting mauled by a dog. And so then we kind of riffed on it and was like, you know,
that's
he was wearing his meat britches or something like that, and the dog got after him. You know, I don't know. I think I actually used that in the Goon somewhere.
I was going to say this sounds like a Goon subplot somewhere.
Yeah, I think that was. I think meat britches was used in the Goon somewhere. I'm pretty sure. I'd have to go back and look, but I'm pretty sure I used that because that's too good not to use.
Sure, absolutely. And, speaking of our buddy Mike, every time I read the Goon and I hear about Norton's Pub or see Norton, is that where you got the name was from Mike?
Yeah, I was trying to think up a name for the pub, and I was like, I'm Norton's.
There.
It was kind of like a little shout out to Mike.
If you go to, is it thegoon.com? That's the website for the Goon, correct?
Yeah.
There's some great YouTube videos there, an interview for Dark Horse, and then there's the Goon mock movie. What is it? The Goon mock movie from San Diego.
Panel from Comic-Con. Yeah.
Exactly. And it said that Norton would be played by Chris Rock, which I think is perfect casting. So, because if you've never met Mike Norton, looks a lot like Chris Rock. So I thought that was perfect. What was
it? Well, Norton the character isn't modeled after Mike. I just, you know, took the name.
There, you mean he's not a short, stubby, bald man?
No. He's kind of a tall, hairy guy.
That would be Mike. Actually, you guys kind of have the, you know, the brother vibe going on. You both have a little bit of the Tennessee Mountain Man look.
Oh, maybe, it must be Tennessee, yeah.
Well, speaking of San Diego, you had a couple fun things there. You had the mock movie panel, which you have to talk about how you guys came up with that, and they came up with that whole idea. But then you also had the Beauty and the Geek costume contest.
Oh, yeah.
So that had to be kind of a fun San Diego for you.
That day, the movie panel was a couple of years before, and the Beauty and the Geek thing was last year, or this year, whatever. That was actually, I was getting kind of shuffled around from place to place really fast, so I actually didn't really enjoy the Beauty and the Geek thing, because I was all like, oh, crap, we got to get out of here, because we're supposed to be, like, announcing at the Eisner Awards, and, you know, this was a TV show, and I thought they could probably care less about, you know, the schedule of some comic book guy, you know,
Who so they're probably not even going to know what the Eisner Awards are.
Yeah, but yeah. They were really cool about it and hurried up our segment or whatever and got us in there and out so it wasn't too bad. It was pretty fun listening to those guys, you know, pitch their superhero ideas. But
how did you even get pulled into that?
They approached Dark Horse. They were wanting some comic book creators, and you know, they asked if we'd do it. They're like, okay, yeah, we'll do it. So
there you go.
Good promotion. Plugged on TV, I guess.
Absolutely. You know, I saw where did I see the? Oh, Superbad.
Oh yeah.
Did you have any idea, for anyone that hasn't seen Superbad out there, there is, you know, bright as day, a big goon poster in one of the bedrooms. Did you know that that was going to happen, or do you have any idea?
Yeah, they asked permission. The funny thing is, I didn't know. I heard that there was some goon stuff in there, but I didn't know exactly what. They just asked permission if they could, you know, use the goon in the movie. And I said, yeah, of course, because I'm a big, you know, Judd Apatow and Seth Rogen fan. And but when they initially asked me, they asked, is it cool if we have two kids rolling a joint on a goon comic? And I was like, yeah. I was like, that's awesome. Yeah, of course, you know, you guys can do that. And so I didn't know how they were going to use it, so I'm kind of going into the movie thinking, like, are they still going to roll a joint on a goon comic or something? But no, I guess that they, whatever that was for, they must have cut it out or something. But
you felt a little jilted after the show then.
Yeah.
It was right.
Yeah, they had the poster on the wall, so that was cool.
Well, in addition to the goon, which is obviously your passion and your creator owned work, and you've made an incredible world there that a lot of people should go and check that out. You've also worked in some mainstream comics. You worked pretty heavily in the Whedonverse, in Buffy and Angel, and here just recently on Action Comics with Jeff Johns on the Great Escape from Bizarro World storyline. What's it like working, you know, with other people's creations? Is it kind of nice to take a break from the world of the goon? And what was it like working with Jeff Johns?
It was really cool working with Jeff. He was really open to let me throw out suggestions as far as, like, I mean, I didn't have any suggestions as far as the, like, major plot, anything like that, and I would have, you know, not felt right even making suggestions about the plot. But any, like, little quirky thing I wanted to throw in there, I was like, what if we did this, and can we throw this character in there? And he actually asked me if there are any characters I want to throw in. And so that was really nice. It's really nice when someone, you know, will listen to your opinions. And so that was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to work on my schedule, because I was working on that the same time as Chinatown and a couple other things. My schedule was just completely insane, and there was a lot of pressure during that time. That's my only regret about that, is I wish that I could have taken more time with it and actually been able to calm down and enjoy the fact that I was getting to draw a Superman story.
Sure.
But yeah, it's every time I do something like that, I'm really glad to return to the goon, though, because there's no restrictions. I'm doing anything I want, and I'm just having so much fun with it. There's really nothing that can top the level of enjoyment I'm getting out of doing the goon.
Sure. That's one of the things that, you know, we hear repeatedly from folks that work on their own creator-owned stuff. There's just, you know, as much as you want to go and draw Superman or Batman or Spider-Man, there's really nothing quite like your own work that you're going to be able to leave your mark on. And, you know, I think the goon is one of those perfect examples of, you've created a world that is very much yours, and it's Eric Powell's the goon, and that's how it'll always be looked at. So that's got to be pretty cool.
Oh, I hope so.
Well, I tell you what, Mr. Powell, it has been a pleasure talking with you. We'll wrap up here with what's coming up with the Goon now that you're back on a regular schedule with the series. What do we have to look forward to?
Well, you know, this year we're taking it monthly with Dave Stewart doing the colors and everything, and there are a few reasons I wanted to take it monthly in 2008, because one was just to give the fans, because there has been such a long gap while I was working on Chinatown, I wanted to give the fans, you know, a little payback and go, you know, here's the big chunk of Goon comics for you, you know, since you've been waiting. And the other reason is there are lots of things that are coming to a climax in the story. Some things that I couldn't really get to until Chinatown was finished. And now Chinatown is out there and everyone's read it and they know that story. So now I can kind of take the next step forward in the, you know, the overall story. And there are some major shakeups and the roles of certain characters are going to change. And it's, so it's going to be an exciting year for people who like the Goon.
Any thoughts about ever returning to graphic novels and making a second Goon graphic novel?
Yeah, I really want. It was like I mentioned before. It was really kind of liberating to be able to go in and go, okay, this story's going to be as long as it needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. It doesn't have to be 22 pages or, you know, 44 pages. It can be whatever it's going to be. And have that kind of freedom with the visuals and everything. And I really enjoyed it. And I want to do it again. And who knows, maybe a few years down the line, you know, when I start getting older and I don't feel like killing myself, maybe I'll just turn the Goon into, you know, some graphic novels or something. I don't know. But who knows, that's a ways away.
There any plans or thoughts on maybe doing work outside of the Goon? Not even at Marvel or DC, but you know, creating an entire other line of creator owned work outside of the Goon world.
I've got a couple of other stories I want to do, and eventually I'm going to get to them. But yeah, I think the majority of my work from here on out is going to be creator owned stuff, even if it's not the Goon. I just really love the freedom I have with doing my own material. Drawing, you know, drawing superheroes and stuff you grew up with is really fun, but I get a lot of satisfaction out of doing my own material, so I think I'm going to kind of stick to that.
Well, we wish you the best of luck, and we'll be reading whatever you do whenever it comes out, whether it's the Goon or otherwise. But Mr. Powell, it has been a pleasure talking with you. Enjoy the rest of your Tennessee winter down there, where it's nice and nice and warm in comparison. And know that you can call on us anytime, and we'd love to talk to you again.
Well, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
And we'd certainly like to thank Eric Powell for taking time out of his busy schedule to talk with us. Make sure to go to thegoon.com to check out all things The Goon on the internet. Now let's educate you a little bit, or edutain you a little bit, with the Quiet Panelologist at work as they continue their A to Z, or Z, of British comics.
Welcome back to the Quiet Panelologist at Work A to Z of British Comics.
Hooray!
Hooray, and this week we're on the letter I. So, have you got an I, Matt?
I have, John.
I've heard you got four. My I, Matt, is Ian Gibson.
Ian Gibson? Who's Ian Gibson?
He's an artist.
Oh!
And he's best known probably for his work in 2008, where he drew such stories as Robo Hunter, Ace Trucking, and The Ballad of Halo Jones.
Oh wow, see how it all links together.
Which you know all about.
Yeah.
When it comes to his US work, he's probably best known for drawing Mr. Miracle in 1980. Do you remember that?
No, I wasn't alive in 1980.
Alright, okay. But since 2000, he's been back at 2000 AD, and he's been drawing comics like Judge Dredd.
Ooh.
And that is all I know about Ian Gibson.
Do ya?
I know that he once built a car made of nothing but Dairy Lee triangles.
Never.
I may have made that up.
Oh, okay.
That's it.
Well, that's very informative of you, John.
Yeah, it's like a small information nugget.
Okay.
Like an in-fugget.
In-fugget. Mm. Well, my eye for the A to Z of British comics, John, is international.
International?
That's right.
For British comics?
Yes, Comics International.
I see what you've done there.
Yes, Comics International is a British magazine about comics.
Wow.
Comics International magazine provides up-to-date news and reviews of comics from around the world.
That's incredible.
But there is a particular focus on the British comic and comic book creators.
Right.
It's very good.
Yeah, it's good.
Originally printed 16 years ago on black and white newsprint, the magazine now features full-colour glossy covers as well as colour pages inside.
My God, it's like a proper magazine.
It's come on in leaps and bounds.
Yes. Maybe people would want to read this, Matt. Where would they read it? How would they get it?
They'd simply go to their local comic shop if they lived in the UK.
What if they didn't?
If they don't live in the UK, they can probably order it online.
From a UK shop?
Yeah, why not?
Maybe they could go to their website.
They could go to comics-international.co.uk.
Yes.
And they could probably find it there.
That's published by Quality Communications, isn't it?
It is published by Quality Communications, who have also, famously enough, published Warrior and Miracle Man and V for Vendetta. Quality Communications is a company formed by Des Skin in 1982.
I see.
Now, if you can imagine, see, if you're in the States, you've got Wizard, full-colour, glossy magazine, probably about 300 pages.
Like that.
There. Well, Comics International is like 2000 AD sized, about 100 pages, most of it black and white. It's a bit more like a newspaper, but more of a magazine. More like a magazine newspaper cross.
Right. Is it still now? I've not read it for some time.
No, nor have I. But currently, for example, in this month's Comics International, there is an interview with Dan Slott, he of the Initiative.
Right.
An interview with Will Pathiafa.
Pathiafa.
And an interview with Pat Mills.
Ah.
Features on Spider-Man 3, Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer. Also regular columns include Talking Shop, Frame to... What?
Their latest issue.
Mm-hmm.
Up-to-date news is a feature on Spider-Man 3.
Oh, yeah, this... Actually, yeah, this is June 2007 I'm looking at. No, but we recorded this back in June 2007.
Oh, right, okay.
So this is our latest, the latest news.
Okay.
Well, the info might not be up to date, but Comics International, the home of the UK up-to-date comic book news and reviews magazine.
Sounds great.
Yeah, I kind of messed that one up,
didn't I? We've done them a real service by even mentioning them.
Oh, thank you, they should be pleased.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Quick, we'll dash over and just move on to the next one.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
And a big thanks, as always, to Matt and John from the Quiet Panelologist at Work. Remember, you can check out their podcast by going to panelologist.com. You can also find their podcast by going to the Comics Podcast Network. They're a member of the network just like we are, and Collected Comics Library and a host of other podcasts. You can find all of us there by going to www.comicspodcast.com. And now let's move on to one of our other favorite segments here at Around Comics. Each week, Professor Jeremy Mullins drops some knowledge on us about the ever-changing world of webcomics. It's certainly not hard to find webcomics, but it is hard to find the ones that will appeal to you. And if you were lucky enough to listen to last week's episode, Jeremy suggested a webcomic by a former guest of Around Comics, Cameron Stewart. If you know his work from Sea Guy with Grant Morrison or The Other Side with Jason Aaron. Well, Cameron is doing a webcomic called Sin Tutelo, and go back, listen to last week's episode, and you can find out all about it, or you can go to the forums at aroundcomics.com, and we have a sticky thread that keeps track of all of Jeremy's webcomic recommendations. So you can do that each week and find out what those are. But for this week's recommendation, here's Jeremy.
I feel like crud this week. I am sick as a dog. But old Cammy Knoxville from the forum might have shot me just what I need to cure what ails me. And what he shot me was a link to a webcomic. That webcomic's called Lucid TV. You can find it at lucid, comicculture-tv.com. Check it out. It's a comic strip. It's about the resident staff of the Jim Belushi Memorial Hospital in Juneau, Alaska. It's created by John Tiberius Kuh, Dave Rothline, and Hutch Armstrong. And, you know, on the surface, it looks like a doctor soap opera strip, a la, like, Rex Morgan, M.D. or whatever. But in the strip, the doctors are total jerks. So, in that way, I guess it mimics real life. But, essentially, there's a lot of black comedy. There's truckloads of your baby's dead, or your spouse is dead, or Andrew W.K. is dead. Humor. Actually, the Andrew W.K. strips are what hooked me. There's a lot of twisted humor. Falls right in line with the White Ninja comics or with Perry Bible Fellowship. It's not as bright and cheerful as PBF. It's dark and has a lot of contempt for the common man. I find it a little wordy at times, but I have to admit, I did laugh out loud once I started going through the archives. And, well, when I laughed, it made me cough. And when I cough, I hurt. So, thanks, Cammy Knoxville, for making me hurt. I want to apologize to everybody for the sound quality of this for this segment. I know y'all are pretty sensitive when it comes to the quality of the recordings. Again, I probably sound like I'm in a tin can. You'll have to excuse me this week. But check it out, Lucid TV, lucid-tv.com. Hope I can get lucid. And so, for Around Comics, you know, I'm Jeremy W. Mullins.
Jeremy Mullins is a professor of sequential art at the Savannah College of Art and Design. You can find more about the school and its programs of study by going to www.scad.edu. This portion of Around Comics is brought to you by Ape Entertainment. And available for order in the February issue of Previews is Bizarre New World. The critically acclaimed series returns in a new prestige one-shot. After the first miniseries, the cat is out of the bag. The worldwide population suddenly gains the ability to fly. A desperate phone call from his son forces Paul Crutcher to run the gauntlet of insanity to get to Arizona. But with chaos ripping across the planet and everyone airborne, the journey through California won't be easy. Find out why AintItCoolNews.com called Bizarre New World one of the best new comics 2007. Pre-order your copy of Bizarre New World, Population Explosion, from the February issue of Previews. And to purchase the original three-issue miniseries, head to your local comic shop or visit our friends at Ape Comics by going to www.apecomics.com.
Welcome to Answer Man, the portion of the show where a very tired Tom has to climb a building of truth while swatting away pesky biplanes of questions. I'm very tired. I'm extremely tired. I've been working a lot lately. My heart's not in it 100%. Just, you know, in the interest of telling you guys the truth, I'm a little down. I'm a little down, a little lonely this morning. It's cold in my apartment. I had to go to Starbucks to get coffee. I don't like Starbucks. They're so tired. I couldn't be bothered to walk to Dunkin' Donuts. So I bit the bullet and I went to Starbucks, and it was a mess in there. I don't know what's going on. People getting the wrong scones and complaining I can't get a goddamn coffee for the life of me. Everyone's angry. It was a bad way to start a morning. And so I'm taking that negativity and I'm going to bring it here. I'm going to cast it through the internet at you. But, you know, I'll try and reel it in a little bit. This week, I've introduced a new element to Answer Man, and that's called audio. As in, someone has left an audio question, two questions, and I'm going to try and answer both of them. So let's go straight to the audio. Audio, begin now.
Hey, this is Ma'at on the forum and the Fixes Hideout podcast. This is a call for the Answer Man. I want him to answer this question, since you're going to speak about the Legion next week. Answer this question about them. How many different incarnations have there been, and who were the writers of each incarnation? All right? Thanks a lot. I'm enjoying the show. Take care. Bye-bye.
Ah, the dreaded Legion question. The one I've been fearing since I threw out, you know, the idea of covering stuff and asking me questions. I knew someone was going to ask me about the Legion. And the funny thing is, I always get a feeling when people ask me about the Legion, they are Legion fans. And it's like a test. It's like a nest of vipers waiting to leap on me when I give exactly the right answer. So, here it goes. You know, I'm just going to whip out what I know. It's not going to be completely comprehensive. That would be an entire show in and of itself. But, you know, I want to give a little bit of a highlight of the Legion of Superheroes. I've always sort of enjoyed the concept. You got to remember that these characters are the sort of teenage friends of Superboy. And such as that, their origin was sort of as backup characters in Superboy stories. They'd appear from time to time, and as they became more popular, they sort of developed a backup feature, and they were always sort of around, and they sort of moved around from book to book. They were, you know, in Adventure Comics for a while. Finally, in the 70s, I believe they got their own series. And that was sort of, my favorite era is actually the Paul Levitz era. The current bigwig at DC was a very good Legion of Superheroes writer. You also got to remember, right before that, you had Jim Shooter, who was 14 years old. He was sending in complete layouts with the word balloons already drawn in, and they were hiring him, you know, to do that sort of stuff. So, those old, 60s, 70s stuff, I've always enjoyed quite a bit. As you move into the 80s, you have your Keith Giffen, who I always really associate with the Legion, was involved in that. And continuity-wise, all that stuff sort of fits together. The problem is, once you get to Crisis, and you got to figure out a way, there wasn't a Superboy, really, for a while. So how does that history fit in? So they kind of docked around it a little bit for a while, and they didn't quite reboot. But, they did what everyone does, and they find a way around it, and I guess you could call it kind of a soft reboot. They did a 5 years later jump forward that Giffen did. One year later, just a chance to sort of start with a clean slate. They didn't really have like a really completely hard reboot until Zero Hour, which really messed up the future of the DC universe. So the Legion had to deal with that. And during this time, we had Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning were working on it. And I wasn't a huge fan of all that stuff. I thought it was very well done, but it was kind of lost, I think, a little bit once it sort of got rid of the Superboy element. Then, in 2005, they relaunched Legion of Superheroes again. So there was another reboot written by Mark Waid, art by Barry Kitson. I love the first 12 issues of that series. I thought it really nailed home the concept of, kids fighting against what they believe was the corrupt world of adults. And that's always the beauty of the Legion of Superheroes, is when it's pure to what it is, it's about banding together with your friends against a whole world that's lined up against you, whether if you're a kid and it's adults, or you're a rebel and it's the police, because there's always a big element in the Legion stories about the science police being a problem. And I don't want to sort of whitewash Legion and pretend that there isn't a bunch of continuity issues within Legion of Superheroes, but I would like to offer the fact that I think it's a strength of the concept, is that because the future is always malleable, you can always have a different Legion. You can just kind of start over, the basic templates for the characters are there. I love Brainiac 5 is one of my favorite characters, and I love how there's a couple of different versions out there, and that's all right. You pick and choose. The writers pick and choose sometimes. We've recently sort of seen the return of the pre-Crisis Legion kind of in the Lightning Saga and the JLA JSA. They haven't really gone into the specifics of is it really the pre-Crisis Legion? What's going on? And I'm fine with that. I guess I've given you no answers. This was my fumbling attempt to talk a little bit about the Legion. You could do a whole show about the Legion. They have such a long history, and they've been, so closely tied to Superman, the granddaddy of all the characters. So I've always suggest that any of this sounds interesting, if you like any of those artists, check out the Legion of Superheroes. You can get a lot of the back issues for very cheap, in dollar bins and 50-cent bins. I've gotten a ton of the Paul Levitz stuff that way, which I've always really enjoyed. And now we have a second question, and let's see if I can not fumble my way through this. Once again, audio begin now.
Hey, this is Ma'at again calling for the Answer Man. Just wanted to respond to episode 166 statements about the age of the people who were asking the questions about the Teen Titans year one. I happen to be 42 years old and believe that continuity is important, even though I do accept your point about opening your heart. Continuity is important to a degree in the sense that people have experienced these things, have these particular memories of the stories in their heads when they read these new takes on these the superheroes, and they expect to at least have that acknowledged in terms of the writing of the reimagining. It shouldn't be just chucked out with the baby, you know, the bathwater and the baby. So that's why people get in a huff. I know you understand that, but, you know, it's always good to remind you also, even though you reminded us, that continuity should be relaxed a little bit. It is important, especially to those who have read those stories and enjoy those stories. All right? Thanks a lot for your answers. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Ma'at, you glorious bastard. You had to go and ask me about continuity again. I accept that the fact that, yeah, continuity is sort of, it's important to people. It's sort of what brings them back to the books. But you also have to think, it's not like in Teen Titans Year One, Robin strangled and killed a hooker when he was 13. He used IM. You know, and there's a line to be drawn somewhere where stuff like that has got nothing to do with the character. It's the stuff around it. It's the opportunity to tell a certain type of story. That's still Robin. I didn't see anything in that story that went against what I thought Robin was. You know, and I didn't see anything that was outrageous about any of the characters. They, you know, that's how they acted. I think when you get caught up in the trappings, you get caught up in, why aren't they wearing 80s clothing? You know, that's not nothing to do with story. That's the ephemeral, that's the peripheral stuff to the story. And you gotta be careful, you know. I suggest people read the newest Keith Giffen column on Comic Book Resources, because he talks a little bit about continuity. And he says, you know, continuity can be strangling. What people want is consistency. You want Robin to be consistent. You want Dick Grayson to sort of be treated consistently. But that's, you don't necessarily, people shouldn't necessarily have a fit if he's using instant messaging. And I think there's a line, you know. I think there's a point to where you gotta let those things go. They're not trapped in a certain time period. And I don't know, I feel like people sort of like take ownership of the characters and feel like I love the Teen Titans, and every Teen Titans story has to be for me. That's not true. I mean, there's not every story is written for, you know, you, not you specifically, Maya, you know, but you, whoever you are the fan of that's complaining about whatever, you know. Not every story is written for you, and that's okay. There's still ones that are written for you. And just relax. That's all I'm saying. That's all it goes. I'm not saying they should go and change it that, you know, the Flash was a meth dealer when he was 13. I mean, that doesn't make sense. Can he use instant messaging? I think that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. Well, now that I fumbled my way through probably the longest Answer Man yet, I will sign off. Good day, people. Enjoy your comic book reading, and I will speak to you next week.
Each month, writer Will Pfeiffer entertains us with Catwoman. Every week, he educates us about what's coming out in DVDs. Here is Will with his new DVD releases and his cult DVD pick of the week.
This week's top DVD release is Martin Scorsese presents Val Luden, a smart, sophisticated documentary about the legendary horror producer, narrated and produced by a legendary director. If your knowledge of horror movies begins with Saw and ends with Saw 4, you really need to see this disc. Back in the 1940s, Luden proved that less is more in a series of low-budget, high-quality horror classics like Cat People, I Walk with a Zombie, The Seventh Victim, and The Leopard Man. This doc covers all those movies with plenty of clips and expert analysis. Once you've seen it, you'll probably want to check them out for yourself. Thankfully, almost all of Luton's movies are on DVD. Also out this week is the sixth season of Curb Your Enthusiasm, the hilarious HBO sitcom from Larry David, the cranky co-creator of Seinfeld. This is arguably the strongest season in the show's history, with Larry inviting a family of displaced hurricane victims into his home, giving Ted Danson a book of freaks for his birthday, and, in the most shocking and funniest development, finally splitting up with his long-suffering wife Cheryl. If you miss the bitter laughs of Seinfeld at its best, check out Curb. And because it's on HBO, there's plenty of swearing, too. This week's cult DVD pick is Tapeheads, a very funny 1988 spoof of the early days of video, starring a very young John Cusack and Tim Robbins. They play Ivan and Josh, a couple of would-be filmmakers who start a music video business and get involved with a conspiracy involving, well, hell, the plot doesn't really matter. It's the oddball jokes and strange character bits that make this movie worth watching. Soul Train host Don Cornelius damn near steals the show as smooth-talking record executive Mo Fuzz, and the boys' hip-hop ad for Roscoe's Chicken and Waffles may be the best 3 minutes in the entire history of 1980s movies. Be sure to check it out. I'm Will Pfeiffer, and this is the DVD Report for Around Comics.
You can find Will's written reviews at the Rockford Register Star by visiting go.rrstar.com and going to the entertainment section. You can also visit Will's blog at willpfeiffer.com, and remember to read Catwoman every month. Writer Jerry Duggan first came to our attention as part of the creative team with Brian Posehn and Rick Remender and Hilary Barda and Michelle Madsen on The Last Christmas. Well, since then, Jerry's been kind of a reoccurring guest on the show. He helped us with our Frank Miller retrospective, and we've kept a pretty good relationship with Jerry going over the last year or so. Well, he has a new project coming out from Image called Infinite Horizon, and I wanted to drop him a line and see how the project was going and have him tell folks a little bit about it. Well, we got to talking, and before we got to Infinite Horizon, we spent a lot of time talking about what's going on in L.A., which is where he lives, and of course the topic of the day is the WGA strike. So we start our conversation really talking about the strike and what's going on in L.A. and how it's going to start affecting our entertainment here in the not-so-distant future. You may notice in one part of the conversation we talk about the Directors Guild, and just be aware that this interview was recorded before the Directors Guild came to their contract agreement. So here's a pretty long talk, but an interesting one, I hope, for you about the WGA strike and Jerry and Phil Noto's new project, Infinite Horizon, which you should certainly be checking out. Here is my conversation with Jerry Duggan.
It's really taking its toll on, certainly my friends and my comrades and stuff. It's a long time to be out of work. But there are instances where, writers can write non-struck work. It gets a little complicated, but, not everyone is an NBC sort of gig. And that is, a problem, but, the WGA will have to organize, those non-union shops after they get through the strike, I think. But, so not everyone's out of work. Obviously, anyone on a union show or a big network.
Sure.
You know, the writers have the moral high ground, and you know, they're winning the PR battle. I think the thing that the media moguls are counting on is just they're counting on people, you know, either facing bankruptcy or going what's called financial court, mm-hmm. which basically allows a writer to sort of go back to work for, you know, strictly financial reasons with no penalty. There hasn't really been too much of that yet. Sort of a unique position because I'm not a WGA member. Most of the TV that I've written for has been for basic cable, for shows that were not produced by WGA signatory companies. But, you know, Brian and I, Brian Posehn, my writing partner, last Christmas, we started to get a little traction with a Last Christmas movie, mm-hmm. and it was optioned by a producer before the strike. And so when the strike's up, you know, we're going to get back to that. And as soon as that happens, you know, I'll be a must join, you know, and I'll do so happily. I've done some work with the WGA in the past in terms of organizing and sort of some grassroots campaigns. And, I was, you know, supporting. I was actually walking some of the picket lines some of the time, some of the days that America's Next Top Model was on strike.
Sure.
Because I had some friends on that show, but it's sort of a strange thing to be working now. Like, I'm working at G4, but I'm very fortunate to have a job, and, you know, anytime that I can take a study that's in the Guild on strike at the lunch or pick up a meal or something, I'm happy to do it. A lot of people are hurting.
We talked with Mark Sable and Robbie Rodriguez, who doing stuff for Oni and Image, and they're both out in L.A. as well, and say it's trickling down even to, like, I think Mark said his hairdresser had mentioned that the strike is affecting their business.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, even the Starbucks in this area, you know, are down like 30-40% depending on the exact location, but the thing that I don't know that people realize is that there are different reasons for wanting the strike to go on. It's strange, you know, there's probably only 6 or 8 men that sort of control the fate of the strike, and for, the, you know, everyone at Fox, they're very happy that the strike is happening because they're the least affected. They have American Idol coming back now, and they want everyone else in the crapper. There could be other companies that want their competition weak because they want to buy them out. Nobody really knows. Everyone basically has an agenda, and even the moguls could be operating at cross purposes. So I couldn't be happier that Letterman made a side deal with the Guild. I hope all of these producers that want to agree to give the Guild a fair shake, I hope they all get side deals. I hope my producer, if he's able to, you know, get going, like, that would be great. I don't know if that's possible, but, like, any side deals that can be made, I think, are fantastic. Get as many writers back to work as possible and really put the pressure on the people that are controlling this to get back to the table. Because they walked away. I can't tell. It's very strange. I can't tell what the rest of the country thinks because I sort of am reading Deadline Hollywood Daily, which is written by a LA Weekly reporter named Nikki Fink, who she's basically been the one person on point. She's not been right all the time, and she really, more often than not, has an article that really does speak the truth. So
I think, honestly, the rest of the country, because we're not there, when people will start to really take... most people know that there is a strike, but they haven't felt the effects of it yet. And it's not going to be until the rush of reality TV and the lack of dramatic or comedic and original programming. So, you know, honestly, I think a lot of the country doesn't even really feel the effects of it yet. So
right.
There's going to be quite a bit of lag time on that. And I think that's what a lot of the, you know, like you said, the moguls are banking on that there's going to be a 6-month lag time before the general populace starts to get a little itchy about it.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. You know, we have the moral high ground. I feel, I think most people do. We also have YouTube, you know, in terms of communicating directly with people, the Daily Show writers have done some really great, they put some really great material up. Fred Armisen very funny sketch that was painfully true. The strike, that's available up on YouTube. I hope people understand that, you know, that it's not, it's funny, I saw an article, Millionaires March Down Hollywood Boulevard. The tone of the article, it was online somewhere, was very against what the writers are doing. And you know what, most people, even the people that are out of work understand, or whose show has been put on hiatus because of this, they understand that this is a big fight, that, you know, TV, in a few years, they may just be, you may just be doing an internet show on television. And so, we'll see what happens. It could get really interesting if the actors and the directors go on strike.
It is an interesting time for entertainment all around with internet programming and, you know, the whole appointment television and DVD, which is what a lot of this is all centered around. And entertainment is changing right now, and there's a lot of dollars at stake, and that's this strike is, that's what it's about. It's about the future of how people buy their entertainment.
And I think, you know, for us, there's a lot of talk. It's funny because their studios are really positioning themselves to be the next record company. It's not going to happen overnight, but a lot of the talk on the line, when I've gone down there, is about guys that are networking going, hey, why can't I do this? Why can't I own this, do this, put it on the net? Well, you know, the answer is you can do it. No one's stopping you. And, the content may go the way of Super Deluxe or Funny or Die, or, you know, guys are like, maybe I'll do this as a comic book. I've been wanting to write something. You know, and you know, Joss Whedon and David Milch. David Milch has some really interesting, I guess you'd call them lectures almost. They're really just sort of him sort of thinking out loud about the writer as an entrepreneur. And that's how I feel like making comic books. You know, this is something that we do because we love it and because, you know, it's not a wonderful business model for it. None of us at Image, are really we're not millionaires out of this, you know, like Rick and I and Ivan Brandon and Matt Fraction and Brian, you know, we're making comics because we love comic books. And there's something really satisfying about writing something and owning it and not taking any notes.
Wait, you mean you're not calling me from your yacht?
Not yet. I'm calling you from my inflatable dinghy.
The WGA strike has had kind of an interesting little impact on the comics industry. You know, we'd started to see the crossover of folks that were coming from TV and movies and writing comic books and the back and forth. And now that those ties have kind of been established, now we're starting to see, because of the WGA strike, some folks coming back to comics or some folks that had been spending a lot of time writing TV and movies now have freed up their schedules to write more comics. And I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing.
I'm not sure either, but I know you're right. There definitely is. And part of it is just, you know, part of it is just for guys, you know, that want to, you know, make sure that they have the rent paid. You know, they're trying to think a couple of months down the line. And part of it, you know, might just be like, well, hey, I'm going to pick it for 4 hours and then I'm going to come home and I'm going to write something for 4 hours and I'm not going to write struck work. Mm-hmm. I might as well write comics.
Sure.
You know, that's not struck work. Here's something that I can enjoy. You know, for a lot of the guys, like the big name guys, they're doing it, I think, because, you know, they get a kick out of it and stuff. And, you know, who am I to stop them? I'm not necessarily so sure it's such a great thing if something starts but doesn't get finished, you know, because the writer's strictly not wonderful for comics to kind of have somebody looking for a second issue that never comes or a third issue that never comes. But if it's done right, I think it's great. Anything that puts a comic book in somebody's hand.
One guy that I think is coming from the right place and was already doing comics, but also doing stuff for TV, and like Mark Guggenheim, you know, I'm really glad a guy like that has comics that are going to be there while this is going on, because he was already writing comics before all this started. We had seen what you had done with Brian with, you know, the Simpsons stuff with Treehouse of Horror, which was, you know, really fun, but probably even more so with The Last Christmas. But you have Infinite Horizon, which you're working on right now, that is, you know, hopefully paying some bills, but you had already kind of built up some equity in the comic industry that way.
Yeah, I, you you know, I hope so. I hope, you know, certainly I feel very fortunate in that, you know, my first comic I got, you know, my safety net was, you know, working with Brian and Rick. You know, Rick is an old pro now, even at a young age. But, you know, and now this new book, you know, I'm working with Phil Noto. I'm a very lucky guy. You know, I sort of have, you know, swung from one coattail to another.
Well, you know, I look at Infinite Horizon, and you're talking Rick Remender, who drew the Last Christmas, and Rick's one of those really amazing multi-talented guys. You know, he can draw, he can ink, he can write. He's all over the place, and he's just an idea machine. And you were a part of that group with Last Christmas with Rick and Hillary Barda and Brian Posehn and that whole group. But Infinite Horizon, as I'm looking at it and read it, this is kind of, I mean, your first book that's you, and Phil Noto is a big part of that book, but this is really kind of your first book, I feel, and it's not a funny ha-ha book.
That was actually the most nerve-wracking part, was that, you know, I'm happy to, you know, write a joke that bombs and just sort of go, oh, well, the next one will be funny, but, yeah, that was a little nerve-wracking, you know, I'll be honest, until I read some of the reviews where people understood it and got it and thought it was done well, that, you know, I had a couple of sleepless nights running up to the debut of the book, but I was really very happy and very, you know, gratified that people have really enjoyed it so far on a whole. I would say, too, I was friends with Phil through my buddy Dave Mandel, and the last thing I wanted to do was sort of, you know, drag him into something that people were not going to like. So, it was a little nerve-wracking, but yeah, I've been really happy. It's been a real pleasure to sort of try flexing some of those other muscles that I haven't really been able to do in any work in the comic book world or in the TV world. You know, on basic cable, you're really, that was more or less paying the bills. There are a few real bright spots, like Icons,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I can say, like, hey, this was something that was great. Even if you didn't love the subject of the show, it's well shot, it's well cut, hopefully it's well written and produced.
Yeah, but with Infinite Horizon, I think that you've taken a lot of risks, and I can certainly respect that, in that, you know, you were known as kind of working on comedy books, and this is definitely not a comedy book. And at the first glance, if you were to walk into a comic shop and open this up, you see soldiers and it's a desert setting. So, okay, this is a book about Iraq. Is it a protest book? I don't know. And it's neither one of those. And I guess we should finally tell people what Infinite Horizon is about. And it's a basically a near future retelling of the Odyssey through the story of a soldier in the Middle East. Was that kind of how you would describe it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a man, you know, look, Phil and I have always loved Westerns. It's a soldier with no name that just wants to get home. Yeah. And we tried to just stay really close to that core idea that there's a great love he's got a wife and child at home and he just wants to get back there. And so this book, I tried to just sort of look down the line at a lot of breakdowns. For me, I'm always thinking, like, what's broken down in this future? Like, I know I have some pretty ideas about things that have broken down that, you know, are hinted at. And I like that people think one thing went wrong or something else went wrong. But the truth is that in this book, a lot of little things kind of broke down to bring us to this point.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, hopefully, you know, the reviews that I read and the people that I talked to have said, like, hey, you know, it's kind of scary that, like, you could, it's not so far out. It's not this crazy piece of sci-fi that that somebody can't get home from the Middle East. You know, it's oil's really high and you know, a lot of the governments and people around the world that the U.S. has kind of propped up, you know, nothing lasts forever.
Well, sure. So, you look at the United States. What are we? 2008. If you go back, 9 years in time and transport someone to today and say this is the world. I mean, that's a huge jump for someone to.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so to maybe transport 10 years in the future from now and say, hey, we're in a world where, it may take 10 years to get back home. That's not that big of a jump.
No, it's, sadly, no, it's not. And, I hope that the political stuff in the book is left, up to the reader, because I have not really had too many complaints that it's one way or another, but I have my own views on it, and I was reading about I think it's stop loss is what it's referred to as, where soldiers think they're getting out, and then just keep the numbers of servicemen at the level that we require right now, that they are not getting out. There's a provision in the contracts and in their military service that they have to go right back. I was also reading things about soldiers that are coming home to inadequate medical care, and then the suicide numbers that are being swept under the rug. And I just tried to think, how are we failing them? And then also, what is just kind of breaking down in our society? People talk about trying to break dependence on foreign oil, and I don't think that there's been a lot of success about that. And as the oil might run out, or as governments change around the world, and certainly people's attitudes towards America are really changing around the world. We tried to set up this future where it could be really hard to get home, and I feel like we did a very plausible death for satellites and email, too. All of that, to me, we depend greatly on this technology, and when it doesn't work, things really grind to a halt.
Absolutely.
I've seen that in television. Oh. Live television from Attack of the Show at G4. If you lose a truck out in the field, a satellite truck, you don't have a feed, and then there's nothing on the air. So you better have a backup plan. You better have a tape package back at the place to sort of run to. And, it's just about, things breaking down finally. And to me, the disasters were sort of more economic. In the infinite horizon, where you just can't pay for the things that you're paying for anymore because there's no money, political will to sort of change things. And so, it's a pessimistic book, but at the core, too, I think in the end it's going to pay off as a love story.
I'm not getting the pessimism of it. So maybe I'm just living in a fairly pessimistic world. It's not that big of a contrast, I guess. But yeah. I've been on this kick lately of watching these 1970s dystopian films. I just watched Soylent Green and A Boy and His Dog this week.
Oh, yeah. I watched A Boy and His Dog last year.
Yeah, and so Infinite Horizon is actually kind of an interesting little companion for those, is that as things break down, I think that you start to see how strong people can be. And that's what I see with the captain, and especially his wife in your book, is that these are people that no matter how crazy the world gets, they get stronger. And that
was important to us too, especially that she remains strong as a character and as a mother and as sort of the center of the storm that's going to engulf them at home. Obviously we have more, we dedicate more pages to his story.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to go through his own sort of trials where he sort of is able to be broken and then remade. So that when he does return home, that that they're able to get back together. She's been very much a rock.
I mean, you can dedicate more pages to his story, but I think that the times that we see his wife and his son, I think can be even more powerful because they are these small moments in between his quests that we're seeing, and I think that they can really rise to be these peaks in the story that kind of keep reminding you why he is trying to get home.
Yeah. I mean, and hopefully it's very grounded, and that's always, that should always be in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
That this is everything that's happening, everything that he's doing is just to get home. And, you know, he has a few different ways. There's, you know, he finds a little more success later on in the story when it's not just sort of brute force, which has always been his way. So he's going to be operating on a learning curve as well.
One of the things that I wanted to ask is because I'm loving the story through two issues, and you know, we talked about the WGA strike and how entertainment's kind of changing, and we've been talking, you know, the last few months about how comics are changing and how the industry is changing, and you know, I look at a book like Infinite Horizon that could have, you know, very easily been a graphic novel. And I wanted to kind of ask you why you and Phil decided to go the route of single issues on Infinite Horizon.
We definitely went back and forth about how best to present the story. There was really only two ways, you know, go with the floppies and make a larger collection of them, or make an original graphic novel. And what it really came down to was, economically, even though, you know, at least in my position, you just sort of want to get to the trade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you sell enough to hopefully cover your costs so that when you get to the trade, you're in a position to make some money.
Mm-hmm.
To get the story out there. But what ended up happening was I just sort of decided in the end that it might help the trade that there already is, hopefully, a little bit of buzz or understanding or something out there, so that you're not just dropping the trade cold. I'm not trying to sort of sell the same thing to somebody twice. You know, I don't want somebody that bought the floppies to then go feel like they had to go buy the trade.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But you know, to be able to sell out the first issue like we did was just fantastic. I was really happy about it, and have those reviews, that puts it in people's mind that this might be something that they want to check out. And I've seen it a little. I've seen guys say, hey, I've looked at the preview online, the first issue's at Newsarama. You know, if somebody wants to go and check it out. And, you know, some of the comments in that thread just say, hey, I'm there when the trade comes out. That's just how I like reading things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't begrudge that, you know, but it does, when you support the floppy, it obviously makes it easier to sort of get out there, you know, to survive to the trade.
Sure. Is there any question that and this happens with a lot of books, is that, you know, if the sales numbers drop, and you guys sold out, so I don't think there's any chance of this with Infinite Horizon, but was there a point where it's like, wow, if we don't sell really well for our first couple, we may not be able to publish every issue in this?
It could happen. I mean, luckily it's not going to happen to us, but yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it also depends what your production costs are. You know, Phil is so talented, and Phil's taking care of so much of the visual look of the book. He is a penciler, an inker, and a colorist.
Yeah,
you know,
that helps.
So that we're able to sort of split those duties down the middle. And, you know, by the time it gets to Ed, we both, you know, I'm it's kind of strange. I'm writing as more than I've ever written on anything, really. I'm doing a lot of drafts, and then I rewrite it after Phil does his work to sort of see if I can improve upon any of the boxes or balloons. But yeah, not everything gets to get collected. There may not be a demand, A, or B, you may just be kind of tapped out from, you know, paying people or the printing or shipping costs or any number of things. And so, you know, it was easier for me to sell Image, to be like, hey, we would like to do a limited series. We never asked to do a graphic novel. We just sort of picked their brain about how they would do it. And they, you know, it helps to have that money coming in. initial orders of X, but you might get a, you know, 3X if it was something that was well reviewed the whole time. There's a very short conversation with Phil, and then a second very short conversation with Image when, you know, we said, hey, this is what we'd like to do. We're sort of making this up as we go, but here's the idea, and, you know, we're really committed to it. And, you know, that was a handshake agreement with Eric and Eric at Image, at WonderCon last year, and then we had the preview out for San Diego. I appreciate everybody, you know, trying the book, and, you know, thank you so much for spending your time with me to, you know, help me promote it. I'm glad that they enjoyed it, and I hope that everyone else does too. You know, it's a labor of love for Phil and I. We both have our other jobs and responsibilities, and then we're up late nights doing this.
Sure.
You know, it's just been fun. It's been a real pleasure to work with Phil. He always manages to surprise me, even when it looks exactly as written. I don't really know how to explain that except to say it's either a color choice here or, you know, an angle on a shot somewhere else. But it's just really been very gratifying, and it's been a lot of fun. And I hope, you know, I think our third issue is our best yet, and I'm working ahead on 4 and 5, and he's working on 3, and, you know, that's sort of the one that I'm most excited about. I guess every issue is the one that I'm most excited about.
You're definitely a name that we have on our radar. Any time that we see Jerry Duggan on a comic, we're gonna check it out, and we always, man,
well,
I was
really nice to hear. I really appreciate it.
You know, you haven't done anything bad yet, so we can't vilify you and hang you on the cross yet. So, but whenever you do, we will.
When I deserve it, pick up the phone and call me.
You got it. We'll finish up here, and but this won't be the last time that we talk. You know,
please do. I always enjoy our conversations, and keep up the work on the show. It's a really wonderful show. It you know, raises the discussion of comic books to a really wonderful level. You know, it's always great to hear you guys on the show. So I thank you again for having me on, and I look forward to next time.
And a big thanks to Jerry. It's always a pleasure talking with him. So please check out Infinite Horizon. I think it's one of the more unique books on the shelves today. It's definitely telling a different story than you're going to find in a lot of other comics. So good stuff from he and Phil Noto. Let's get you ready for the week ahead. Here is Collected Comics Library's Chris Marshall with his Trade 5, going over this week's new trade paperback and collected edition releases.
Hey everybody, it's time for this Monday's Trade 5, and the list this week is going to be pretty short and sweet. I'm only going to go over the new releases. I'm not going to go over any news this week. If you're looking for news, come by my website over at the CCL. And I'm blogging just about every single weekday, so I'll get you caught up in all the links over there, news and information regarding hardcovers and collected editions. So let's look at DC Comics this week. Batman, The Man Who Laughs, the hardcover, collecting the graphic novel The Man Who Laughs by Ed Brubaker. This collection also includes Detective Comics 784 through 786, which is a murder mystery guest starring the Green Lantern, Alan Scott, my favorite Green Lantern. This book will sell for $20. Another Batman hardcover is out this week, Batman Falls Faces, and this collects Detective Comics 787, so one storyline into the next right here. This also collects Batman 588 through 590, and Wonder Woman 160 and 161, and Batman Gotham City Secret Files. This book also sells for $20. Moving on, we've got Outsiders Checkmate Checkout, the trade, collecting Checkmate 13 through 15 and Outsiders 47 through 49 for $15. Manhunter Volume 4 Unleashed, the trade, collecting 24 through 30 of that series for $18. And a book that I'm sure will be talked about in many different circles, Incognegro, the hardcover for mature readers from Vertigo Comics in DC for $20. Over at Marvel, we've got the New Avengers Illuminati Premiere hardcover, collecting 1 through 5 of that series for $20. X-Men Endangered Species, the hardcover, collecting X-Men Endangered Species one-shot and chapters 1 through 17 of that whole storyline for $20. Young Avengers, the hardcover, collecting Young Avengers 1 through 12 and the Young Avengers Special for $30. New Avengers Transformers gets a trade, collecting New Avengers Transformers 1 through 4 for $11. Not sure if anybody actually read that story. Or even if it fits into Civil War, right? Next up, we've got Uncanny X-Men Rise and Fall of the Shi'ar Empire, a must-read for any X-Men fan, collecting Uncanny X-Men 475 through 486 for $30. And a second printing of Marvel Masterworks Silver Surfer Volume 1. This is the variant Volume 15. This collects Silver Surfer 1 through 6 and the Fantastic Four Annual Number 5 for $55. What's interesting to point out about this book is you may want to go out and find the Silver Surfer Omnibus. I think you can still find it. At least you can check on online places like eBay for sure. But what the Omnibus will not include is this Fantastic Four Annual Number 5, which I think it is actually the very first solo story of the Silver Surfer, if I'm not mistaken. In any event, it is included in these Masterworks and not included in the Omnibus, so buyers beware. Over at Dark Horse, we've got Predator Omnibus Volume 2 for $25, and we also have a neat little book out this week that I like to call Star Wars, The Knights of the Old Republic Number 25. This is Vector Part 1, a storyline that's going to go through all the Star Wars titles over at Dark Horse throughout the entire year. And yeah, I know I deal only with trade paperbacks, but I'm a big Star Wars comic book guy, and so I had to mention it here. I'm sure Sal and Chris will be talking about this when they do the new releases of the monthly books that are going to be coming out. In any event, that is it for my report this week. For Around Comics, I'm Chris Marshall, Collected Comics Library.
Thank you kindly, Chris. Remember, you can check out the Collected Comics Library by going to collectedcomicslibrary.com, the aforementioned comics podcast network, and know that nobody knows collected editions quite like Chris Marshall. Well, let's move on to the single issue releases. Here's our own Tom Caters with his highlighted list of what is coming out this Wednesday.
Good morning, welcome to the new releases for Wednesday, January 30th. Let's go to the board. From DC Comics, we have Action Comics number 861, the continuation of the Superman and the Legion of Superheroes story by Geoff Johns and Gary Frank. I've been enjoying it so far, so I'm eagerly awaiting the next installment. We have the wrap-up of Black Adam, the Dark Age. Peter Tomasi, Doug Mankey, story about Black Adam. I dropped it after the first one. I had a little bit of Black Adam burnout, but I am curious to see sort of what the critical reaction to that is once it's done. New issue of Green Lantern, number 20. Lantern? I like how I said that. Green Lantern, number 27 coming out. Big fan of the Geoff Johns run, so I'm eagerly anticipating that. We got The Spirit, number 13. This is going to be a mixed issue. Various artists, various writers, all dealing with the femme fatales of the Spirit. So it'll be a bit bittersweet with the end of the Darwin Cook run, but hopefully, you know, we pick up hot and heavy once again. From Marvel Comics, we have Captain America number 34 by Ed Brubaker and Steve Epting. It's the new Captain America is in this issue, the one with the gun that caused oh so much hubbub. We also have coming out number Fantastic Four number 553, the end of the Dwayne McDuffie Pelletier run, which I've enjoyed a lot. The next issue after that will be the Mark Miller Brian Hitch. So if you've enjoyed the McDuffie, this is it for you. We also have Mighty Avengers number 8 coming out. That is so much quicker than I would ever have anticipated. We had New Avengers Annual number 2 coming out. This, of course, is dealing with the Hood, which, I mean, God, so many issues with the Hood, but I've been enjoying it so far, so I hope it keeps up a tradition of fine annuals that we've been getting lately. We have the premiere of Spider-Man with Great Power, written by David Lapham. I'm sure I've pronounced it wrong one of the two ways. And Tony Harris doing the art. Yet another Spider-Man story for all you Spider-Man lovers out there. We also have coming out from Vertigo
Well, you know, the end. The end is here, my friends. Why the Last Man has reached the last issue. It's Why the Last Man number 60. It's probably too late for you to jump onto this series right now, so, you know, I'd wait for the trade if I were you, if you haven't started yet. It's the conclusion. I'm a trade behind, so don't tell me anything. Don't email me any info. From the world of independence, we have Black Summer number 5 from Avatar. It's probably one of my favorite Warren Ellis things that are going on right now, so I'm looking forward to it. We have the premiere of Narcopolis, written by Jamie Delano, famous for his work on Hellblazer with artist Jeremy Rock, another Avatar book. It looks pretty good. Usually the Avatar stuff has a nice cover, but the interior art sometimes leaves a little bit desired, so I'm looking to see if this maybe, you know, it's a little better than I think it's going to be. We also have the premiere of Alex Ross's Project Superpowers. Well, it's a zero issue. It's a buck. Written by Alex Ross and Jim Kruger, artist Steven Sadowski. It's Alex Ross's reimagining, working with a little bit of the Golden Age characters that have been tossed aside, and that's coming out from Dynamite. We have Proof number 4. I'm loving the Bigfoot book, so I'm looking forward to that. We have Salem number 0. You might remember Salem, Queen of Thorns, was the issue with they got the Wiccans pissed off. So, yeah, good luck to them, and good luck to the Wiccans. We have Suburban Glamour, number 3 of 4, the Jamie McKelvey story about a very attractive hipster girl who is a fairy from another dimension. I'm enjoying it. And that's about it for this week. Talk to you next week. There'll be a whole new batch of awesome books to get, and I look forward to reading all of them. Good day.
And that will take care of another Monday edition of Around Comics, the Comic Culture Podcast. Remember to come back on Thursday and enjoy the Around Comics Roundtable. You can visit us online by going to www.aroundcomics.com. You can email the show at info@aroundcomics.com or me personally at chris@aroundcomics.com. You can check us out at Comic Space and MySpace. You can be so kind as to leave a review at the iTunes Music Store. Everybody knows that is my favorite. So come back on Thursday for that roundtable discussion. And in the meantime, in between time, you know that we will be everywhere in and around comics. Views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, rebroadcast, or retransmission without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole property of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2008. I'm still writing 2007 on my checks. I hate that. Got my loving, baby, now you gone. Got my love, baby, now.